Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering a variety of steak, salmon, and chicken breasts for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
On the west side of Salt Lake City, on a patch of industrial land, state leaders want to build one of the largest homeless service campuses in the Intermountain West. They're hoping it will be a solution to a fractured system. The facility is supposed to cost about $75 million to build, another $34 million a year to operate, and lawmakers have committed some of the money. The governor is asking for more. Officials are looking to Washington to fill the gap. Critics have called it an internment camp. They say it seems more like detention than shelter, which gets us to another part of the story. More than 5 months after the site was announced, there is still no final operating plan, no clear public consensus about how this place will actually function, like who will be sent there, whether certain people could leave, and under what conditions. Jose Davila IV, he's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, he says this moment has revealed a new ideological split about how to address homelessness in the state. On one side, there's the concept of housing first, which has been around for a while. It's the idea that you have to start by giving someone permanent housing with no preconditions. You stabilize them first, then address their issues later. There's now a new concept that's being promoted by what Davila calls a new wave of thinkers. This has come to be called treatment first or civil commitment. It's the idea that for a certain segment of the homeless population, those who are deeply addicted or in the grip of psychosis, housing alone just isn't enough. So you have to detain them and take care of them before any real change is possible. It's the Utah Homeless Services Board that's going to have to decide which approach to take. And Davila took us back to where that story began last year.
So the board chair is a man named Randy Shumway. He's a consulting CEO. He was made the board chair after the 2024 legislative session that saw a lot more business types kind of be added to the board, and the board's size shrunk. Independent of the board, he went before a legislative committee earlier in the fall to pitch legislators on his dream for the campus. His idea was that this large campus, which when it was originally announced would possibly be 1,300 beds, bigger than anything else the state currently has. He said, I want 400 beds for mental health treatment. I want 300 beds for substance abuse treatment. And those should be involuntary. You know, he argued that that was what would help homeless Utahns the most. That was the first time I had heard that this campus would perhaps offer more than just low barrier shelter and, you know, services attached to that. So that was pretty big news. Shumway said that the governor and legislative leaders had tasked him with coming up with this idea and specifically tying it to President Trump's summertime executive order on homelessness and crime. So he pitches that there, but he tells legislators, I haven't got the full backing of the board yet to do this. They have one meeting. They talk a lot about Shumway's ideas. Some of the board members seem to share his ideas, others don't. And then in November, Shumway says, okay, I want to get all these various stakeholders, these service providers, experts, to come and pitch the board on what we should use this campus for.
Let's call the meeting to order. And Shaylee, if you don't mind, will you do a roll call?
So it's a gallery.
Mayor Sheree Wood.
Of groups making
Randy Shumway
here.
Short presentations on
Mayor Aaron Mendenhall.
What they think the campus and the homeless services system needs. On one hand, You've got a couple organizations.
So my name's Joseph Grenny. I'm chairman of the board of the Other Side Academy and the Other Side Village.
Saying, hey, we need more civil commitment.
We need to be holding people accountable. And if that means involuntary detention for a period of time. So if I'm out committing property crimes or petty crimes, if the jail system isn't the right place, there needs to be a place where I am held accountable long enough that my head clears.
And that's why it's so important that we have really firm mechanisms to step in and be able to provide care to those who are unable to choose it for themselves.
And then you have other groups of people that are more interested in talking about, hey, if we build this thing, we need to make sure we have a plan for getting people out.
I'm Catherine Fife, Associate Deputy Mayor of Salt Lake County.
That was something Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County said.
We must plan for long-term housing and supportive services as people, individuals exit.
So it was a really interesting meeting because it showed how approaches to homelessness and improving the homeless services system here differ.
I'm trying to show readers that Utah's homelessness response is up in the air in a way that it hasn't been maybe since the Rio Grande shelter closed. This is a turning point, and there are different views as to where exactly the state should go to deal with what is an ever-escalating homelessness crisis. What's at stake is the lives of homeless Utahns, how the state gets them help. And then, you know, there's funding at stake here. There are taxpayer dollars that are currently spent in one way, in some cases to help people stay in their homes right now, that could be reoriented, could be spent on involuntary commitment, behavioral health care, and a big, shiny new campus that could hold way more people.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to talk about the philosophical foundations of these two approaches to homelessness, what they assume about human nature and freedom and about the role of government in people's lives. Let's go back to Jose Davila IV. He's the West Side Communities reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune.
The split on display right now is there is kind of a new wave of more conservatively aligned folks who think that the key to solving homelessness in Utah is to build a slightly more punitive system, one that takes people off of the streets and gets them the treatment that
forcibly
they need.
Takes them off the
Correct.
Streets. Correct.
Yep. Almost everybody says that there is a lack of behavioral health care services. There's a lack of case management. So, you know, if you build up those things, maybe more people can come into them voluntarily as well.
Yeah.
So there's this one group who thinks, okay, we don't want camping on the streets. That should be illegal. It is illegal in many cities in Utah. And so we need to make sure that those people get the treatment we think they need and that they are not causing a danger to others, right, whether that be other homeless people, whether that be you and me walking down the street.
Yeah.
Then there's another group that sees that the biggest problem with the homeless services system right now is simply that it's not funded enough.
Yeah.
That in that lack of funding, there's a lack of housing. There's a lack of kind of in-between housing. Transitional housing is what they call it. There's also a lack of permanent supportive housing. So that's housing for people who will never really be able to live on their own. But that doesn't, of course, mean that they should live in squalid conditions.
Yeah. This is the idea that I've heard described as housing first as a concept. And what they seem to be saying is that, look, the system housing first, this system that we have, could work. It's not perfect. But if you, policymakers, would just fund it more, if you would focus more on the idea of actually coming up with housing, it will work. Like, you're jumping the gun saying it's not because we haven't tried to test its potential in that way. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Housing First has been an idea that's long percolated and actually long driven federal housing policy, which then, of course, influences state housing policy because that's where all the money comes from.
Yeah.
It's the idea that you try and get somebody who's homeless into Housing First and then help them with anything else they might need,
right,
whether that be substance abuse treatment, whether that be getting an ID, helping them find a job, whatever the case may be. We think it's better for them to have a stable place.
Yeah.
To get them those services. That has largely driven Utah's homeless services system. However, there is still a supply issue.
Yeah.
There's still not enough affordable housing, deeply affordable housing, transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, whatever kind of housing you think someone might need, there's probably not enough of it. People kind of on the other side of this, people who've long been running this system, people like Heather Hogue, who's a homeless services provider and board member of kind of these more local, one of these more local councils, they believe that if we build more housing and get people to and through that housing, especially if it's transitional in nature, that means that we can free up other people coming through the shelter system and moving through the system more quickly.
Yeah. Let's say Utah's homelessness, you know, policy board adopts the – I mean, I'm jumping the gun here a lot. But let's say they go with the treatment first option, the idea of let's forcibly take people and put them into, you know, mental health and addiction services. If they were to go with that option, how would that alter Utah's response to homelessness? One of the things you mentioned in your article is it would mark a really major transformation and change.
So I think the biggest thing is that the change could reorient some of these federal dollars to more intensive treatment, to deeper case management, that sort of effort, instead of going to housing programs that actually do have people in them as we speak.
Right.
So that's a concern for some advocates. This campus, if kind of adopted as this new wave of leaders see, would really become the central hub of homelessness response. It would certainly offer a lot of involuntary treatment. People would likely be held there for longer than 3 months to, one, get better, and two, then help them onto their next thing. So that would be a big change. It could also mark a change for our current shelter system. Right now, we have what are called homeless resource centers. This was the big move from that big Rio Grande shelter into these dispersed centers that have no more than 300 people in them at a time. Those shelters could see a change. In Shumway's original pitch to lawmakers early in the fall, he said, we should turn those into transitional housing. Other people have talked about maybe they are just targeted for specific subpopulations. Maybe one becomes a homeless veterans center, right, for example. So that would be a big change as well. In all, though, if Utah decides that we need to pour more money into behavioral health care for homeless people or people who are on the verge of homelessness, whatever the case may be, that would take quite a significant reallocation of funds. That is really expensive. Maybe there are new funds that the state unlocks. Who knows? Maybe the federal government unlocks them.
But. Right. But are these funds that potentially could be going to housing?
Correct. Almost certainly.
Yeah.
And in some cases already are.
So the idea of housing doesn't fall by the wayside. I don't want to put it that way. But it takes – sort of goes into the back seat in terms of the way the state if you were to adopt this approach. Is that right?
That's – I think that is right for some people.
Okay.
So the governor has pitched to the legislature, hey, I want $20 million this session to focus on so-called high utilizers. These are people who are chronically homeless, have been homeless for a long time. They maybe have interacted with different parts of the homeless service system. Maybe they've stayed in a shelter for a period of time. Maybe they went to a rehab center, but then when they came out, they fell right back into homelessness. These are people who cycle through the system. And despite interacting with the system and the help that the state offers and nonprofit providers offer to them, they have not been able to get back on their feet. this pitch for involuntary treatment is largely focused on those people because they have deeper mental illness problems, deeper substance abuse problems that constrain their ability to get into housing or keep housing without deeper intervention. And so this approach to give those people treatment instead of saying, hey, here's a Section 8 voucher, go live on your own. The argument is that, hey, if we get them treatment first and then they have the skills to live on their own, that's going to be more successful for them. Now, maybe we'll get to this later, but it might be a good time to note that our current shelter system does work relatively well. 75% of people who go into an emergency shelter in the Salt Lake Valley leave it within 3 months.
Well, this is the counter that's made by advocates. They're saying you're talking about as if the system is completely broken, but the system isn't completely broken. As you said, three quarters of the people,
they leave the shelter within 3 months.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that they all go to a better place or they're all automatically everything solved for them.
Yeah.
But it's an emergency shelter. That's its job.
Jose Davila IV, he's the Westside Communities reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering a variety of steak, salmon, and chicken breasts for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. State leaders want to build one of the largest homeless service campuses in the region on the west side of Salt Lake City. They say it's going to put some stability into a system that's stretched to its limits. Critics say it's just a glorified internment camp. But while they're working out the money and the politics, they also have to figure out the facility's guiding philosophy, that is, how it should frame Utah's response to homelessness. So we've been talking about how it's revealed this clear divide between the old guard homelessness advocates and a group of new thinkers who are arguing for a different philosophical approach, one that includes involuntary treatment, that is, locking people up. We have with us the Salt Lake Tribune reporter, Jose Davila IV. What would it mean to adopt a treatment-first idea? You have to lock them up, basically, right? So how does that change things? If you're holding them against their will, it turns into a secure residential placement facility. That's one of the terms I've heard. So that means guards, I guess. It means that they have to stay there for a certain amount of time. The question is how long. They can't leave. Does it require separate space? Does it require a separate facility? And again, you sort of already addressed a little bit of this, but it also requires resources.
Yeah, so it's certainly a more complicated way of what proponents say of helping homeless Utahns.
Yeah.
You obviously are going to have people coming into this facility that are unwell, whether that be due to substance abuse, whether that be to mental illness. That can obviously create dangerous situations for people working with them, for others in the same facility. Having security is a big part of this. Kurtz believes people need to be held for more than a year to really get better and really put these illnesses behind them. And so, yes, they would be long holds, and therefore they would be obviously expensive.
Yeah.
Now, this is really tied to the campus idea. If the campus was built as Shumway intends, which is maybe our best kind of working idea that we have right now, It seems possible, likely even, that you would have a place for people who are recovering from substance abuse. You would have a place for people who are learning how to deal with severe mental illness. And then you would have some level of low barrier emergency shelter, probably.
The state's really temporary.
Yes. The state still needs emergency shelter beds for families whose apartments burn down, for elderly people who get evicted. It still needs that. The state still needs that. So if we're going to have this mix of populations at this site, that requires, yes, a lot of security. It requires, you know, separation between these different groups because you don't want more traumatic incidents happening to people. Homelessness is traumatic. Even staying in shelters is traumatic, right? Yeah. And so
– sounds expensive.
Yes, it is. It is certainly expensive, and that is something that proponents have said and do understand.
From the other side, those who say, let's keep at this housing first policy. Let's not lock people up for, you know, months and months and months and possibly years on end. One of the concerns that I've heard, or a few of them anyway, I don't want to describe them as abstract, but there are two things that aren't as quite tangible. One is that they would trample civil rights. And the other one is that if you lock these people up, it just makes homelessness even less visible. Will you talk a little bit about the arguments they're making in that way?
The civil rights concern is based in this idea that generally under federal law and therefore state law, yeah, it is very hard to get a judge to say, hey, this person is a danger. They must be ordered to treatment. That's not to say it doesn't happen. The Utah State Hospital is generally where Utah treats these folks.
Right.
It's not very big. And in fact, there are a lot of people who have been ordered to undergo involuntary treatment who are still out on the streets or in another housing situation. So that is an issue. Some proponents of this new idea want to loosen some of those civil commitment laws to make it easier to send people against their will to what is more or less a jail. You can't leave.
Yeah.
You will face penalties if you try to. But, you know, the goal isn't to have people go and think about what harms they've caused society. The goal is to get them better. That's what proponents say.
Right.
So that's the civil rights concern, is that there's going to be more people who are going to be forced into treatment against their will and what advocates say unnecessarily.
Right.
In terms of the less visible criticism, this is kind of a longer range view. Advocates, service providers, people who work in the system as it is now, believe that if we just build this campus out in this rural neighborhood on the other side of two highways and we just throw 1,300 people in there, we're just warehousing people. And if we don't get the funding, if we don't get the funding to run that effectively, it's just out of sight, out of mind. And I think a lot of their concerns are based around upcoming big events that this city is hosting.
Like what?
The temple reopening and the 2034 Olympics.
Right.
And so they believe, these advocates, the other side of this argument, believe or are concerned that the people pushing this agenda just want to get people off the streets, out of sight, out of mind, without providing the things that they actually need.
Yeah.
I will say, like, this other side, these kind of old guard, let's say, I mean, they don't want people sleeping on the street either, right? They think that's a dangerous thing. And generally speaking, continue to advocate for more beds, both emergency beds, as well as more housing.
So you mentioned in your article that Governor Cox, the Senate president, the Speaker of the House, they didn't reply to your requests for comment. Can you say something about that? What do we know about how they feel about this idea of compelling certain homeless people into treatment?
What we know is kind of based on their reactions to the campus, you know, moving forward bit by bit. So generally speaking, the Senate president, the House Speaker, and the governor are cheering on this effort. They seem to be willing to try something new. They seem to be open to this more punitive approach. Last legislative session, as listeners may remember, there was a big push from legislative leaders on Salt Lake City to clean up its act. They kind of argued that the city was not doing enough to secure public safety, and dealing with homeless people was a part of that. And so they have signaled certainly some interest in that. The governor, you know, we have some more recent statements, mostly via his budget. So the governor in this legislative session asked for $25 million to help build this campus. Now, former homelessness coordinator, the state's first homelessness coordinator, Wayne Niederhauser, when the campus's location was announced, said, I think it'll take $75 million to build and $34 million a year to run. Legislators already approved $23-ish million to the campus in the 2024 legislative session. Now it's 2026. Governor wants another 25. Obviously, do the math. That's still a $25 million gap. And then the governor also asked for $20 million to target high utilizers. These are those people that are kind of cycling through the system but haven't found their way back to their feet.
Yeah.
So the governor seems supportive, and the governor seems interested in
But does he seem supportive? I mean, is he actually asking for money for the idea of this particular idea, I guess?
When I asked him specifically about this ongoing funding for high utilizers, he said, I think that money should go towards running the campus. That is a part of this campus idea.
But it wasn't necessarily for let's put in many millions more to build a very secure set of facilities and pay for basically what is a jail.
Correct. He has not, at least publicly, seemed to have taken a stance on exactly what the campus should look like.
Hmm.
It seems to me that legislative leaders are and state policymakers and state leaders are giving the Homeless Services Board the role of figuring that out right now.
They're trusting them to work it out, and some may hope they go one particular way, but for now they're saying, you guys work it out.
And look, the Homeless Services Board is made up of governor appointees.
Sure.
It is made up of appointees from the Senate president. It is made up of appointees from the House Speaker. There's a couple other seats that are appointed by different people, but generally speaking, I mean, that's the bulk of the board. You would assume they are relatively in lockstep, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so finally, let's go back to that question that was playing out in November. They're trying to work out an approach. They heard all these different pitches. I'll sort of oversimplify it a bit. One was stay with housing first. One was let's go with treatment first.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's too early to say which one of those is leading right now, or what can you say about where they seem to be about picking an approach?
So Shumway has still said that he wants to take more feedback. I think his ideas are pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
His ideas could change.
Yeah.
But they're still taking feedback. But I think the most powerful players in the system, like state leaders, the incoming homelessness coordinator, Randy Shumway, they all seem to be more interested in expanding involuntary treatment. There are dissenting voices. There are people who, like Josh Romney, who is the board chair of Shelter the Homeless,
right,
which is a nonprofit deeply embedded in the current system that owns many of the shelters that currently make up the system. He'll still look to assure those shelters' role, and he's still really interested in building more housing. Gail Miller, who has long been a big donator,
yeah,
to homeless causes of different types.
Right.
She has given to the Other Side Village, which is kind of more in line with pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
We're going to give you treatment while we give you housing. But she's also given to the current shelter system. She just made a big announcement in the fall that she's making a big donation to put more money into maintenance at these current shelters. So there are big voices on either side, but from my point of view, it seems like the involuntary treatment, the treatment-first approach, is in the lead.
Jose Davila IV, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug.
Jose Davila IV, he's the West Side Communities reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll put a link to his reporting about this story on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. today in the program, we've been talking about the difference between these two approaches to homelessness. One side, housing first. You start with stability, no preconditions, then you help with addiction and mental health issues. But on the other side, there's a newer idea. It's called treatment first. It's the idea that for some people, housing alone just isn't going to work, that they're going to need attention before change is possible. And one of the leading voices for this treatment-first approach is Devin Kurtz. Kurtz is the director of public safety policy at the Cicero Institute. As you heard earlier, it's a conservative think tank based in Austin, Texas, founded by the tech entrepreneur John Lonsdale. Kurtz has lobbied across the country for policies like bills to ban camping on the streets as a way to address homelessness. He said the Cicero Institute influenced President Trump's executive order on homelessness last summer. But Kurtz doesn't actually fit very neatly into the typical MAGA profile. Before joining Cicero, he planned to attend seminary and become a prison chaplain. He served for a time as a prison minister in Vermont, and all of this inspired by his Quaker faith. Kurtz told us the homeless population isn't a monolith. He said, understanding the different needs of these individuals is the basis of his philosophy.
Of the population I'm most concerned about, the unsheltered, the chronically homeless, the severely addicted, severely mentally ill, those involved with the criminal justice system, those on the sex offender registry, I mean, yes, it is dirty and dangerous. That doesn't make them less human. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't care for them. Our lack of care for them is part of the problem. Now, we have to also understand that there is a different level of functioning. There are people who are homeless quite briefly, who are there primarily for economic reasons. You know, they may have been evicted, and can actually get back on their feet quite fast. This is a population who probably is never on their feet. The men that I worked with in Vermont's prison system when I did prison ministry, most of the guys I worked with were sex offenders. Some of them were quite bright and had, you know, if they probably weren't going to get released, but if they were released, I think could actually, you know, do quite well. And there were others that I knew would be at a very, very high risk of homelessness if they were released. They were unable to function at an appropriate level of independence for what our expectation would be for them.
So what was appealing about the ideas in the Cicero Institute? Because one of the central ideas here is that it's involuntary, mm-hmm. that for a time you have to impose a solution. You have to get them off the street through coercion, through force, sure. And you have to lock them up. And I suppose what you are saying is maybe it's imperfect, but it seems like the only way to actually do this.
So I think that we often, you know, I've worked on, I don't know, dozens of pieces of legislation that are said to criminalize homelessness. I prefer the term regulate. It's regulating street sleeping, much like many other activities we do in public. You know, is regulating littering criminalizing it? I suppose. Are people going to jail for littering? Not typically. We often, when we look at those pieces of legislation, they get labeled as, oh, you're trying to jail homeless people. My hope is that none of them go to jail. So now there, if people are committing crimes beyond that, have a long list of warrants, then perhaps that is the right place for them. Maybe that is the only intervention that will work.
Wait, what's the difference between putting them in an environment, a shelter, and jail? It seems like the same thing, no?
Well, you mean putting them in a shelter involuntarily?
Yes.
Sure. So I think that this is one of the – and I sense where you're going with this is one of the characterizations of the Utah Homelessness Campus is that it's a homeless shelter that people would go to involuntarily. I think that is a misunderstanding. It is hard for me to conceive of a shelter that has locked doors. To me, that doesn't really make sense. You either have – a true jail where there is due process to enter that. And then you have involuntary civil commitment, which I'm happy to get into, which is currently primarily used as a method, as an entry point into hospitalization, the most sort of extreme medical clinical interventions. I'm a big proponent of being able to have other types of sites other than hospitals that you can be civilly committed to, that would still be, you know, perhaps greater than a full outpatient community setting, but not as acute as a hospital. I would like that to exist. I don't envision that as a homeless shelter. So the way that I think about this and the way that perhaps it's been reported on, the way that it's been talked about in hearings quite loosely, I have a hard time mapping an involuntary shelter onto those buckets that I just laid out. So
So what's your vision? What should it look like?
Well, I don't think it should be 1,300 beds. I don't think that something of that scale is necessary. I think that when we look at why is Utah, why are so many places in the country dealing with such a severe homelessness crisis? To me, it's a system flow problem. There was a time where this was my testimony to the Homeless Services Board a while back, I think last November. When you have a facility or what was called transitional housing, which usually was a group housing placement that had a set of requirements, usually a program agreement, and instead of a lease, instead of saying here's your apartment, it's an agreement. We're going to give you some housing for say 12 to 24 months, and here are the expectations. If you don't meet those expectations, then we can remove you from the program,
yeah.
And you can't be part of this community. Key thing is that they're staying there 12 to 24 months and then moving on to some level of independence.
One of the pillars that's going to drive the function of this homeless campsite, encampment, is treatment first.
Mm-hmm.
And your argument is that a good portion of that is going to require involuntary treatment, locking people up for a certain amount of time. It seems like you're saying 90 days isn't enough. We need to really do this.
Yeah.
But we also have to take into account those who are temporarily unsheltered. You have to take into account substance abuse, which is
– Yes. What the system needs to be better at, and this is where I think Randy Shumway and the vision he's articulated for improving the system, the governor and his three pillars, and where I align with that quite closely, is we need to tailor the intervention to the individual. And there are groups of individuals, you know, there are ways that we can classify them to better intervene, to better design programmatic interventions. I am not saying that the answer to all types of homelessness in Utah is voluntary civil commitment for psychiatric or substance abuse treatment.
Right.
That is the solution for some of them,
right.
For the ones that are the hardest. I mean, what I always emphasize is that I love voluntary interventions for those that can respond to them. But the people who will always fall through the cracks, who will fall through the cracks of homeless outreach, who will fall through the cracks of the shelter if they get there, who will fall through the cracks of permanent supportive housing, even with assertive community treatment, all of the acronyms under the sun for the voluntary interventions we have, the people who will fail them is the meth-addicted schizophrenic sex offender. So the people who fall through all of these systems, that's the population that not only will not respond to the system that we've built, they haven't. We know that. We've seen the number of mentally ill people who are living on the street, not even in the shelter system, in Utah over the last 10 years since the largest expansion of Housing First ever, that number has gone up by 390%. We know that they're twice as likely to be living on the street. So that's the population I think is not being properly served, and the stakes for them to not be properly served is the highest.
Okay, so you don't believe Housing First. Like, that's not the right way. But you're not against the importance of housing as being one of the components of a solution, it sounds like what you're saying. Because a lot of what advocates are saying, what critics of this idea of treatment first are saying is that, look, oh, yes, the system's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's working well enough. And
working
also
– for whom is
well,
the key question.
Well, okay. That's fine. But I think the argument they're also saying is also how do we know – because the legislature hasn't appropriated enough money. We're not spending enough money to actually build enough houses to actually test whether or not it works.
I mean, the federal government spends between $3 and $6 billion a year on Housing First and has since, I mean, 2013 was when you started to get pretty much it was the only intervention that the federal government was going to prioritize. Prior to that, you still had Housing First, but it was to lesser degrees.
Yeah, you're talking about federal, but are you suggesting that the state has spent enough? Is spending
Utah
enough?
Utah spends more money on homelessness than I think any other state that I work in. And I admittedly work in primarily conservative states, but Utah is unusual in how much money it spends at the state level on homelessness.
And you're just saying it's not spending it in the right ways.
They're not spending it in the right ways. My view is that Housing First simultaneously overestimates the needs of some and underestimates the needs of others. So for your individual who is not severely mentally ill, not addicted to substances, does not have a criminal history, is primarily there for economic reasons, could be disabled, but disability is a spectrum. So they might be able to work but not work as much. They may be on some amount of government benefits. For that individual, a housing intervention, a primarily or only housing intervention is appropriate. But permanent supportive housing is forever. That person might not need subsidized housing that is targeted to the homeless population forever. So they're getting overserved, in my view. Housing First then looks at someone who has a ton of complications and oversimplifies their problems. So they don't actually succeed. The other people, I mean, those people are going to stay housed as long as you give them subsidized housing. That's great, but they could probably do as well with less if we were willing to do that. And that's an uncomfortable conversation for these organizations to have with their clients, in part because those are the clients that are the best to work with. Those are the clients who see succeeding. Again, it's the meth-addicted schizophrenic sex offender who is hard to work with. And I get that. But they're the ones that will end up living on the Jordan River Trail, will end up being beaten and mugged, will end up potentially sexually assaulting another homeless person. That's the individual we need to be most concerned with. And it's sure it's going to take some resources.
Well, let's not slide past that. In order to actually develop a proper system to deal with this, it's going to cost a lot of money.
It will.
And does the state have the wherewithal to – I mean, because even if they're sort of deciding how much of this should come to housing and how much of this then should be – even if you get your way and there's some form of involuntary commitment, is it going to even approach the amount that you think is actually necessary to solve that part of the problem, and which is only part of the problem?
Sure, sure. So I think that part of my frustration with the Continuum of Care program, which again is the primary bucket of funding for Housing First and has through federal matching has led the country at every level of government to primarily focus on Housing First. Housing First was originally intended as an intervention for the chronically homeless. It claimed that it would work best for the seriously mentally ill and the most addicted. And it just didn't. It absolutely did not. I have read study after study that claims it, and they all have quite serious flaws one way or another. So I find it sort of frustrating that the intervention that was supposed to be targeted to this high need population has failed. And then everyone is asking, well, your intervention is now, going to cost so much more and it's serving and shifting focus. But they were supposed to be serving this population and they failed at doing it. We understood 15 years ago the need to prioritize this population because they never would get out of the situation on their own. Other types of homeless individuals will, or at least may. These ones will never, without serious intervention. So we have to be willing, I'm not always one to use the term equitable, but we have to be a bit more equitable in our distribution of resources to the highest need individuals. The stakes are a lot higher. These are the people who will die. These are the people who will not move through the system. In terms of funding, in terms of cost, I think that there's a multi-pronged approach that is necessary. There is a certain portion of this population. These are the high utilizers. These are the – you've heard the governor and Chief Red and others talk a lot about these individuals who have dozens of arrests. Those individuals very likely need a criminal justice intervention. that's their primary dysfunction. It may be related to substance abuse and mental illness. We can treat that through jail-based programs, diversionary programs. For substance abuse, the challenge has always been most of the funding mechanisms are, you know, 90-day drug treatment programs. And for someone who's addicted to methamphetamine,
it's not even close.
I mean, we're talking about the symptoms of meth-induced psychosis clearing, I mean, if ever, 2 years after sobriety. So we have to have a much longer view of that. And I think that there's a misunderstanding on how voluntarily someone can give up an addiction. I mean, we hear often, well, they have to be ready for treatment. Let's wait for them. I have a lot of issues with that. It's, you know, to hammer in on the point of cost, yes, this will be expensive. But we don't have to do it for everyone all at once. We need to start somewhere. We need to start taking seriously the needs and saying, if we can save 50 people from the throes of addiction and psychosis, that's a win. This facility, I said earlier, I don't think it should be 1,300, in part because I don't think it should be a homeless shelter. I think this should be a version of a psychiatric and substance abuse facility that is different from a hospital, but has the capacity to treat both of these diseases at a high level of acuity, but also have higher degrees of livability than a hospital, such that people can remain there for the cases of substance abuse, probably 2 years.
And you think that what the state has in mind is aligned with what you have in mind, or at least is beginning to? Because, you know, you say, okay, there are different names for this. Sure. Treatment first, civil commitment, mandated treatment, and then the term punitive always comes up. And I'm wondering what you think about that. You have this big idea.
Perhaps because of my age.
maybe you're young and naive. I don't know. But you have this big idea, and I'm just wondering if all some other sort of fellow quote-unquote conservatives are hearing up at the State House is law and order, public safety, a disintegration of progressive woke policies that haven't worked.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I work in conservative states. I work with conservative lawmakers. I'm a conservative myself.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm in Utah is because things are a bit different here. There is a faith element. There are – when I think of leaders, you know, like Randy Shumway, chair of the Homeless Services Board, Representative Steve Ellison, he has been a voice on this issue and a fighter on this issue for longer than I've been, you know, an adult.
This is what we call the Utah way, by the way.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways it's just another way of saying Mormons do this differently than other conservatives.
Sure. And you know, you mentioned the word punitive. I, again, started my career working in and on prisons. Prison is the most punitive intervention, and yet I still view it as life-saving. Now, my plan is not for everyone to go to prison, not by any stretch. Prison is a very, very difficult place. But its mortality rates are a fraction, a tenth of what we see on the street. That reality is – I mean I bring it up a lot because when it is a matter of life and death – and that is those are the stakes. We saw it in New York when people were freezing to death on the streets. When those are the stakes. I testified in Nebraska 2 years ago. One of the women, homeless women, who testified against a camping ban bill froze to death last winter. When it's a matter of life and death, whether it's from overdose or from the elements or from murder and sexual assault that happens on the street, when the stakes are that high, we have to be very sober about what saves lives. At the margin, prison saves lives. Jail saves lives. Hospitalization saves lives. So we have to find another way. A place of refuge? That's what I want this campus to be. That's what I want every community across the country to have. And it's not a hospital. It's not sterile. It's livable. It's a place where ideally most people They do spend quite a while, but they do leave on the other end prepared for the housing interventions that we're currently starting with. The mantra of the Housing First movement is that everyone is housing ready. I reject that plainly. That is the root of my disagreement, is that not everyone right now living on the street is housing ready. And I don't think they're all going to get housing ready voluntarily. I don't want this to be a punitive environment. I want the opposite. I want it to be a refuge. I understand it's hard for us to imagine violating civil liberties and that not being punitive. But when someone is so sick that they don't realize how close they are to the brink of death, that individual is not exercising liberty. They're sick. And we have an obligation to help them.
Devin Kurtz, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Devin Kurtz. He's the director of public safety policy at the Cicero Institute. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can find us on Instagram at Radio West. You can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.